You know, just when I think this radio thing isn't going anywhere, something surprises me.
Radio is coming back. Radio is once again becoming a carnival and a playground.
That's right. Radio is cool again. And I'm here to tell you, it never left. Because all these stories are from the NPR archives from 25 years ago. I'm Carrie Thompson, and we've got some big fun this month. Like this extraordinary interview with a legendary singer and songwriter, Joni Mitchell.
I've been considered a country musician. I've been considered a folk musician, a jazz musician, a rock musician, a pop musician.
Joni talks about her 1985 album, Dog Eat Dog. And just in time for the holiday season, we'll have the backstory behind It's a Wonderful Life from the man himself, Jimmy Stewart.
I said, if you want to do a picture about an angel named Clarence who can't swim and me committing suicide, I'm your man.
The conversation that would forever alter the course of our holidays and the fortunes of the little town of Bedford Falls. And speaking of Bedford Falls, here are some American citizens from November 1985 expressing what they're thankful for at Thanksgiving.
I'm thankful for my house, my loving parents, to go to a nice school, and my cat.
I think I'm thankful for living longer. I went through a triple bypass operation, and fortunately I came through it, and I'm really grateful for every year I've gotten since then.
I'm thankful for my goldfish, Seymour, because he's cute, and he sits there in the bowl, doesn't do much, sits there in the bowl and keeps me company.
Being able to stop drinking and having my son come to live with me have been the two biggest experiences in my life for which I'm thankful.
Me, myself, being 17 years old, I don't want to have to worry about nuclear war. And while the Geneva Summit talks were just one step closer, and I'm just thankful for Reagan being the man he is.
And I'm very thankful I don't have to eat at my brother and sister-in-law's house because she's a terrible cook. And my children don't want to eat there because her stuffing that she buys from someplace is always kind of gray.
I just wanted to thank a couple of teachers, if you're listening. Mr. Harding, Miss McQueen, Miss Curtin, and Mr. McCarthy, and Mr. Tanner for helping me go through school.
I'm thankful for having parents that love me no matter what I do, and I'm thankful for having good friends, and I'm thankful that we have music.
This time of year, more than any other time, is when I like to get together with family. To sit down at that Thanksgiving dinner and share a community, you know, a family. It's more important than anything I do all year long. So that turkey represents something pretty important to me.
Yeah, turkey means a lot to me too, but to the French, maybe not so much. Here's a story from Alice Furlow in Paris about what Parisians do with their turkey.
I have yet to find a Parisian who knows what Thanksgiving is all about. For instance, a neighbor of mine has the Mayflower confused with Noah's Ark.
Thanksgiving, it's an American holiday, and it's in memory of Noah's Ark landing on Mount Sinai, and all the animals went off, and everybody was so happy to be alive that they fall on their knees and thank God.
Whether they know what to be thankful for or not, lots of Parisians are expected to show up with the Americans for the Thanksgiving dinner at the American Legion near the Champs-Élysées. They'll dance to a band called The Bunch, and everybody gets a free cachet digestif, a French version of Alka-Seltzer or Tums. So, with no reservations for Thanksgiving dinner in Paris, where shall I go? Harry's New York bar is serving merely hot dogs, and neither the Chicago Pizza Pie Parlor nor the Big Love Cheeseburger sound quite right. I've decided on Conway's, the nearest thing in Paris to a Third Avenue bar. There are autumn leaves and scarecrows in the window, and when I stopped by, Patrick, the manager, was busy translating the menu into French. He's expecting a lot of Paris natives to join in the feast this year.
Then you have the roast turkey, which is the main thing, I think, in Thanksgiving dinner, and very important, dinde rôti. And you have candied sweet potatoes, which are pommes de terre douce en français. And one of also the most important things, the cranberry sauce. C'est une sauce d'érelle. We have a great pumpkin pie here.
Now, how is it? What's it taste like, your pumpkin pie? Is it made by a French chef?
It's made by a French chef, but it tastes like a really American pumpkin pie.
Tarte à la citrouille is what the French call it, and an Air France spokesman called it horrible. The French serve pumpkin as strictly a vegetable. Still, on Thanksgiving Day, Air France is gallantly serving a turkey dinner with all the fixings on their flights to and from the United States, a transatlantic first. But they're not having Thanksgiving dinner on the supersonic Concorde. There's probably not enough time. For National Public Radio, I'm Alice Furlow in Paris.
And now, turkeys aside, we have an interview with an artist I have admired for a very, very long time. In November 1985, Joni Mitchell had just released her album, Dog Eat Dog. In fact, I'm holding the actual CD in my hands at the moment, a CD that she herself signed when she came into the NPR studios to do an interview with Leanne Hansen. Here's Joni's story from reporter Steve Proffitt.
Dog Eat Dog is full of the honey that has marked Joni Mitchell's music since the 1960s, but it also contains a good measure of vinegar. Joni Mitchell says she's been feeling angrier about things this year. In Dog Eat Dog, she talks about this land of snap decisions and short attention spans. And in a song called Tax Free, she uses actor Rod Steiger to play the role of what she calls an American Hitler, disguised as a TV preacher.
That's an actual transcript from a sermon that was broadcast, and I had the evangelist portraying himself, which is guaranteed litigation. Well, you know, how much do I want to pay for this song? I decided, really, I'd like to stay out of a lawsuit. I didn't, you know, I wasn't out to bring him down so much as to make a point.
Dog Eat Dog is not just a polemic. There are plenty of pop tracks and a wonderfully idiosyncratic number called Smokin' that's based on the sound of a cigarette machine.
We had a cigarette machine in the parking lot at A&M that wasn't well maintained, and the guy who serviced it just never came around. So in the course of the project, first my brand went, then my second favorite, and pretty soon we were down to like L&M's and Kool's and Camel Planes. You really had to be hardcore to smoke this stuff. So one night I said to Skip Luttrell, who was the second on the date, you know, get a long extension cord and let's go mic this cigarette machine. So we dragged it all the way down the corridors of A&M, out into the parking lot, stuck the mic up inside. He went back in, and you hear the coins drop in. Three quarters, that's how long ago it was. And the biggest beat is just the striking of the button, and the little beats are the gears pushing out nothing. Nicotine.
Try another.
Dog Eat Dog is an album squarely in the 1980s. It features synthesizer whiz Thomas Dolby, and it marks Joni Mitchell's first full step into high-tech music. For instance, on the song Three Great Stimulants, she used digital technology to orchestrate the track with a grab bag of unusual sounds.
We'll start with a helicopter blade playing straight eights, set the tempo at this. Then to it, I laid down the guitar part that was familiar to me, and to that a vocal.
I picked the morning paper off the floor.
Then I removed the guitar part entirely and went back and fleshed it out with the many colors that appear there. A chord from Stravinsky, you know, lifted off of the Rites of Spring after Brutality. A chord from Madonna after, you know, ooh, from Like a Virgin. A guy hammering and a burglar alarm bell going off that I captured on Super 8 film in the streets of New York, translated to video and then put onto the tape. In the choruses, the Gregorian men's voices. All of that is instinctive and added a layer at a time, and that was composed in a pretty painterly way.
Artificial news.
As a married woman in her 40s, Joni Mitchell says now is the time to speak her mind. She wrote a song about the starving children of Africa that, unlike the upbeat We Are the World, is a haunting lament for Ethiopia.
That was the first word written for the song. You know, just the word itself, Ethiopia, it's a beautiful word. You know, so I knew that there would be, before I knew what the content, what the pictorial sense of the song was going to be, that that word would be chant-like.
Ethiopia. Ethiopia. Ethiopia.
Joni Mitchell says that Ethiopia is more than a localized tragedy. She says it's a lesson for the rest of the world and for us here at home.
The topsoil flies away, Ethiopia. We pump our full of poison spray, Ethiopia.
Their situation, created by a government who doesn't care, bad management of crops, and the inexplicable phenomenon of weather, could happen anywhere at any time.
Go on and on, insanities, on and on, short-sighted greed abounds. Ethiopia, Ethiopia.
Joni Mitchell is also a visual artist, and her latest group of paintings are now on display at the Corcoran Gallery here in Los Angeles. Her new album is called Dog Eat Dog.
Dog Eat Dog!
For National Public Radio in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Proffitt.
It's Dog Eat Dog.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
The dove is in the dungeon. Whitewashed hawks, hell-hating call hello. Dog eat dog.
Just listening to the sound of Jimmy Stewart's voice, it's almost like someone you know is tapping you on the shoulder. Here, he reveals some of his acting secrets.
If you're able to be up there without the acting showing, then believability starts creeping in. And if you start getting the audience sitting out there to believe what they're seeing up there, well, you're in pretty good shape.
Here's a profile of Stewart by reporter Steve Proffitt.
Jimmy Stewart is a straight shooter. Maybe that's why he was drawn to Westerns. He starred in 18 of them. When you ask Jimmy Stewart what it feels like to be 83, he says it feels old.
To say that I don't feel old would be telling an untruth.
James Maitland Stewart was born in Indiana, Pennsylvania, where his father ran a hardware store. He made his Broadway debut in 1932 and was signed as an MGM player 3 years later. Stewart's big break came from director Frank Capra, who cast him as an idealistic senator in the 1939 Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Stewart spent 4 years as a bomber pilot in World War II, and it was Capra who got Stewart back into the movies and gave him what many consider to be one of his greatest parts, that of George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life.
The phone rang one day, and it was Frank Capra. He said, I got an idea for a story. You're in this small town. Things aren't going very well for you, and you've... Father has a building and loan, and he dies and sort of leaves it to you, and you decide that everything's going wrong, and you're going to kill yourself. And so you're out on the bridge, going to jump in the water, and an angel, and his name's Clarence. He comes down and jumps in the water, and you jump in the water, but the angel can't swim, so you say... He said, this doesn't sound very good, does it? I said, Frank, if you want to do a picture about an angel named Clarence who can't swim and me committing suicide, I'm your man. Please, Frank. And that's, when you talk about Frank Capra to me, I just say Frank Capra was my good luck piece.
I had to act quickly. That's why I jumped in. I knew if I were drowning, you'd try to save me. You see, you did. And that's how I saved you.
Very funny.
Your lip's bleeding, George.
Yeah. I got a bust in the jaw in answer to a prayer a little bit ago.
Oh, no, 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 George. I'm the answer to your prayer.
Alfred Hitchcock said the reason Jimmy Stewart is a great actor is his ability to remain Mr. Everyman, no matter how bizarre the situation. Hitchcock chose Stewart to star in four of his films, as did director John Ford. In 1970, Stewart teamed up with his lifelong friend Henry Fonda in an often overlooked but delightfully comic western, The Cheyenne Social Club, directed with great taste by Gene Kelly. Stewart appeared with another friend, John Wayne, in that late actor's last film, The Shootist. After half a century of making films, Jimmy Stewart says he has but one regret.
That I didn't do more theater. That I didn't get back and do more stage work. I've always admired Fonda for the amount of stage work he did. I did Harvey quite a bit, and it was a very, very stimulating thing, and it sort of gets the acting bug in you, get to sort of bring it to life. It's the discipline of the thing. You can't do a second take or anything like that. But that is the thing that I regret. I wish I'd done more on the stage.
Jimmy Stewart made his last appearance as an actor in the 1983 TV movie Right of Way, and he still reads scripts looking for another good part. Stewart says the best advice he ever got about acting came from a now almost forgotten comic named Ted Healy.
The Three Stooges were his straight man.
Healy's advice seems to apply to almost any endeavor.
Never treat the audience as customers. Always treat them as partners. I've sort of kept that in the back of my head. This was 50 years ago. I've just kept it in the back of my head. It's very, very sound advice.
Actor Jimmy Stewart. He passed away in July of 1997 at the age of 89. Now, a profile of author Norman MacLean from reporter Alex Chadwick.
You can talk to Norman MacLean about his book either in Chicago, where he is most of the time, or at his cabin at Seeley Lake in western Montana, where he goes in the summer. Montana is better. It's where the book came from. It's where he's from. And the sense of Montana that MacLean somehow puts into words is at least part of what people remember and talk about. The book is called A River Runs Through It. It is three stories, one short and two long. But the most important to MacLean and to anyone who reads it is the first story, from which the title is taken, A River Runs Through It. MacLean guides a visitor off a logging road and down a trail a few miles north of the Seeley Lake cabin. We are going to a place he and his brother once fished. The woods are enormous. Before we duck into them and out of the light, MacLean stops and looks up above us.
Such beautiful mountains. You thought they had diamonds in them. I would have. I've gone looking for diamonds. Such a beautiful mountain.
The story that Norman MacLean wrote is about his brother, who was reckless and daring and a great fisherman. Either there are a lot of families with reckless, daring, great fishermen, or there's something else in this book that leads those who have read it to press it onto others. It continues to sell 15 or 20,000 copies a year, all of them by word of mouth. The publisher hasn't spent a dime on advertising in a long time, and it's 9 years since the book came out, and the critics called it a new American masterpiece. MacLean was 73 then. He'd never written a book before. A River Runs Through It begins. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. And right in that first sentence, MacLean has managed to tell you what his story's concerned with, family and fishing and some sense of godliness. When we reach the end of the trail, MacLean points out a spot on Clearwater Lake where he and his brother once spent an afternoon fishing from an inflated boat that leaked. They didn't catch anything. By the time he's told the story, it's evening.
Let's go and eat, or drink anyway.
All right.
we go back to the cabin to talk about the book. When people ask me what it's about, I often feel that I can't really tell them what it's about.
Yeah, neither can I. Don't ask me.
I was going to ask you. How do you describe it?
It's about a family with serious problems, but a family that loves itself infinitely. And the love spreads over everything. We stood by each other. We tried to support each other. We tried to excuse each other. And outside, we thought it was a real rough, rugged world and full of bastards. We weren't under any illusion about that. But we tried to set up this world of love as a world against that world. And ultimately, it's a tragic story, of course. Ultimately, we couldn't understand each other.
You wrote A River Runs Through It after you'd retired from a long and very successful career teaching.
At least a long one.
What got you started writing then?
Well, I having taught so many years, I discovered that the problem of identity is, of course, very strong among younger people, and even stronger among those who write about it. They act as if the problem of who we are is only the problem of the young. And the older I got, the more I realized that you go on forever wondering who the hell you are and what you can do and what's best for you. So I was determined when I got to retirement age to find out a little bit more about myself, for one thing. So I committed myself to that, and with the knowledge that to find out whether I could write would mean that I would probably have to sacrifice many of the things that normally people associate with happiness in old age. I figured I would not have time for much company. I figured I would have not much time to go run around with women. I figured I'd have to give up my plans to travel and go to Scotland and so on. And it was a very monastic decision I'd made because I had not written and I did not have the habits built up. I have to do it by what I knew and by my great powers that I hoped I had of self-discipline that I could do without things.
It took you about 2 years, I understand, to finish the book, The Three Swords.
I suppose it did, yeah.
In the process of that, what are the new things that you did learn about yourself?
I guess at least. Well, I learned that I could write well. I've withdrawn from so many people, it's not really, I didn't form new friends, but I even had to withdraw, in part at least, from old friends and not spend the kind of time I used to spend with them. And it's a sorrowful journey.
How do you know you're a good writer? When you read what you've written, how do you know it's good?
I think I just know. And I've spent a life trying to point out what I like in literature, and in so doing, enrich my own power to write.
You taught Shakespeare, Wordsworth?
I taught both of those quite frequently. Shakespeare I taught every year. I thought it was important to me that I don't think I was a Shakespearean scholar, and I never meant to be, but I thought it was important for me to teach Shakespeare once a year just to keep my literary values straight so I wouldn't be running around, as I thought a lot of academic people do, exalting some second or third or fourth rater. If you like some second or third or fourth rater, that's fine, but you ought to know he's a second or third or fourth rater. And just to keep sure you know, you better teach Shakespeare once in a while.
Norman MacLean will be 83 next month, although he doesn't look that old. His eyes are clear. He's solid in the middle. His knees no longer work easily. He walks stiff-legged, carrying his weight in front of him as though he's leaning into whatever's coming at him. If he's irritated, he can still look physically dangerous. This is a retired English professor from the University of Chicago. A little while before he stopped teaching, his wife died. She, too, had come from Montana. His children got him to try writing down his stories. He sent A River Runs Through It around to publishers, who sent it back, one of them noting, with apparent distaste, that these were stories with trees in them. A colleague suggested the University of Chicago Press, but because the press prides itself on a scholastic reputation, publishing such a fanciful memoir was completely out of the ordinary. A faculty committee finally decided the writing itself fulfilled the requirements for publication, being true and original and a contribution to learning. Toward the end of the story, McLean and his brother Paul and his father are together on the last fishing trip they will share.
We sat on the bank and the river went by. As always, it was making sounds to itself, and now it made sounds to us. It would be hard to find three men sitting side by side who knew better what a river was saying. On the Big Blackfoot River above the mouth of Belmont Creek, the banks are fringed by large ponderosa pines. In the slanting sun of late afternoon, the shadows of great branches reached from across the river, and the trees took the river in their arms. The shadows continued up the bank until they included us.
McLean, who eventually got a doctorate in English, started without going to school at all. His father, a Scotch Presbyterian minister, kept him home and instructed him each morning. He had the boy write an essay and rewrite it and rewrite it again. 75 years have gone, and the father's lessons still guide the son. McLean writes in longhand on tablets, sitting at an uncomfortable desk. He works over paragraphs again and again until they're ready to confess. He's been writing a second book for 8 years. A number of his friends think he'll simply never be able to finish. He's infinitely patient in waiting for satisfaction with words, so that if you ask him if there's a sentence in his story that he was never able to get just the way he wanted it, he says no, there isn't. Nonetheless, McLean remains uncertain about what the story means.
When I was young and very young and turned loose in the afternoons in the woods, and when my father used to read to us every day from the Bible or from a religious poet, especially Wordsworth, I began to feel that I would have some wonderful moment that was so designed that it seemed like a story that had been designed by an author. And the older I got, the more my life seemed that way, a series of moments so exquisite, really, is that they and beautiful and true and moving that they almost seem as if they have been planned or plotted by an author. This is still a great problem with me. I have no trouble seeing the designs of many lives, including my own, but I don't know whether that's something I make up or whether it's in the thing itself or in between.
Someone listening to this might say, well, this man's talking about God.
Well, I wouldn't blame them, and I don't have any conventional religion left. What I told you is about, it really is my religion. But I got it also from my father.
Here goes a man who was 73 and had never written a book before, ending his story, reading the last paragraphs of A River Runs Through It.
Of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman. And now, of course, I usually fish the great waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. Like many fly fishermen in western Montana, where the summer days are almost arctic in length, I often do not start fishing until the cool of the evening. Then, in the arctic half-light of the canyon, all existence fades to a being with my soul and memories and the sounds of the Big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, All things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters.
Author Norman MacLean. It's been a swell month here in the cold storage of 1985. I am just thankful for the help of all the NPR broadcast librarians who permit me to check out armloads of CDs every month, and for the expert assistance of Mr. Mike Katziff. Next month, we discover why the holidays are especially stressful for pets. And we visit with NPR's Susan Stamberg and her family at home on Christmas Day. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.